You know, there's a lot of different churches and groups today that claim that they're the one true church. And these different groups base their claims on various things. Some say that they alone are preaching the pure, unadulterated gospel, that they alone hold to the right doctrines. Others claim that they have revelation from God, and that makes them the one true church. Others point to miraculous gifts or supposed miraculous gifts that they say they have, and they say this indicates that they're the one true church. But the claims of Rome are rather unique. It's because the Roman Catholic Church bases its claim of being the one true church on geography. And I'm serious about that. I mean, their basic claim is we're the one true church because the head of our church is the historic Bishop of Rome. And the reasoning goes something like this. Okay, Jesus said that he would build his church upon the rock. And they say that this rock was Peter, and that Jesus gave Peter the power to bind and loosen. So then Peter was the head of the church. And then the second part of this claim is that Peter became the first bishop of Rome, still having all of this authority that Jesus gave him. Okay, and then the third link to them is that Peter passed this special authority that he had on to his successors, the bishops of Rome, down through the centuries. And so that's why we, the Roman Catholic Church, are the one true church. So what we're going to do for the next hour is we're going to look at what the primitive church had to say about these claims. And I'm going to tell you up front, no matter which side of the fence you're on as to this question, as to these claims, I think you're going to be a bit surprised at some of the things that we're going to look at. Well, let's begin by looking at what the scriptures teach about Peter and what the primitive church had to say about him. The key verse that Rome points to is Matthew 16, verses 16 through 19. So let's read those. It says, Simon Peter answered and said, You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus answered and said to him, Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Now, like probably most of you, I was raised to believe that the rock that Jesus was speaking about here was not Peter, but rather it was Christ himself. Jesus was speaking about himself. And I just assumed that I would find that the early Christians held to that same view. That was not even a controversial issue in my mind when I first began reading the early Christian writings. However, this is what I found. I'm going to read to you a few quotations. The first is from Clement of Alexandria, written about the year 195. Find this in volume 2, page 597. The blessed Peter was the chosen, the preeminent, the first of the disciples, for whom alone and himself the Savior paid tribute. So on hearing those words, he's talking about the words there at Matthew 16, he quickly seized and comprehended the saying. So there Clement is saying that Peter was the chosen one, that he was the preeminent, the first of the disciples. Tertullian writes this in the year 197. This is found in volume 3, page 253. Now, Clement was there in Alexandria, Egypt, so he certainly didn't have any bias to want to claim that this is speaking about Peter, or that it was speaking about Peter. because I say he wasn't even in Rome who has made those special claims. Tertullian was in Carthage. That was in the western part of the Roman Empire. But again, it was not Rome. He wrote, "What man of sound mind can possibly suppose that these men," talking about the apostles, "were ignorant of anything whom the Lord ordained to be teachers?" This was part of his message on that the faith was unchanging, that it was complete when it was revealed to the apostles, what we read last night. Okay, but he continues, "Was anything withheld from the knowledge of Peter, who is called the rock on which the church should be built, who also obtained the keys of the kingdom of heaven with the power of loosing and binding in heaven and on earth? Was anything again concealed from John, the Lord's most beloved disciple, who used to lean on his breast?" So Tertullian understood that passage to be saying that Peter was the rock on which the church was built. Origen, writing in the year 228, and he's again in Alexandria, writes this, "Peter, on whom the church of Christ is built, against which the gates of Hades will not prevail, left one epistle of acknowledged authenticity. Suppose we allow that he left a second, yet this is doubtful." Second Peter was one of the disputed books. That's in volume 10, page 346. Cyprian, writing about the year 250, and he's in Carthage, says this, "Peter, upon whom by the same Lord the church had been built, speaking one for all and answering with the voice of the church, says, 'Lord, to whom will we go?'" That's in volume 5, page 341. And finally, the anonymous treatise on rebaptism, which was written about the year 257, volume 5, page 672, says, "Peter himself was the leader and chief of the apostles." So needless to say, I was very surprised to find these quotes, because it had been very carefully instilled in me that Peter had no preeminence, no rights above the other apostles, and that the rock that Jesus is talking about was himself, Jesus Christ, not Peter. Now, on hearing those quotes, your first thought might be, well, boy, is Rome right after all? In fact, a lot of the apologists for the Roman Catholic Church produce those quotes I've just read you in their publications, saying that the church has always acknowledged Peter and his successors as the earthly head of the church. And those verses, those passages from the early Christian writings are not taken out of context. Those are legitimate quotations. However, what I find is that the apologists for Rome invariably do not produce other quotations from the primitive Christians on the subject of Peter that don't support the claim of Rome. You see, I have no patience whatsoever with that kind of approach. Like, we can somehow change eternal truths by shoving certain things under the rug and hiding them and manipulating and all of that. And I'm not going to do it from the other end, hiding the quotes that suggest Peter was the rock or the first of the apostles, the preeminent, and all of that, even though it goes against what I grew up believing, and even though I do not agree with the claims of Rome. To me, as a Christian, our obligation is to be intellectually and spiritually honest. And let's look at all of the evidence, have all the cards on the table, so to speak. Because some of those writers that I just read to you, who say that Jesus' words, "You are Peter and on this rock," were directed to Peter, they often go on to say, sometimes just on the next page of their writings, that saying of Jesus applies equally to all of the other apostles. For example, Clement of Alexandria, I read you a quote from him. Okay, here is a quotation from him preserved in the history of Eusebius. And this is found in volume 2, page 579 of the Ante-Nicene Fathers. Eusebius says, "Clement of Alexandria says that Peter, James, and John, after the Savior's ascension, although preeminently honored by the Lord, did not contend for glory. Rather, they appointed James the Just as Bishop of Jerusalem. So, you know, we have one tradition that, yes, Jesus gave special recognition to Peter, but also he did to James and John. And then, on the other hand, that same writer, Clement of Alexandria, says, yes, but even though he did that, Peter and the other apostles, the other chief apostles, humbled themselves, and they wanted James, the brother of Jesus, to be the overseer, the presiding elder, the bishop, whatever term you want to use, in the church at Jerusalem. Again, from Eusebius, to James the Just, John, and Peter, the Lord imparted knowledge after his resurrection. These imparted it to the rest of the apostles. And the rest of the apostles imparted it to the 70, of whom Barnabas was one. So, again, even Clement, on the one hand saying Peter had preeminence, again mentions John, and also James, the brother of Jesus. So it wasn't a monarchical type of leadership. Origen, I read to you the one quote where he says that's referring to Peter. Yet look at this quotation from Origen. If we too have said like Peter, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, not as if flesh and blood had revealed it to us, but by light from the Father in heaven, having shone in our heart, we become a Peter. So to us, there might be said by the word, by Jesus, you are Peter, etc. For every disciple of Christ is a rock, and upon every such rock is built every word of the church and the polity in accordance with it. For in each of the perfect who have the combination of words, deeds, and thoughts that fill up the blessedness, the church is built by God. So, he first said, yes, this is referring to Peter, but then he says, anybody who makes that same declaration, it was declared to Peter because of his declaration that you are Christ, the Son of the living God. And so when we say that, because the Spirit has revealed that to us, then we're likewise a rock upon whom the church is built, Origen is arguing. This is in volume 10, page 456. And on that same page, Origen continues, but if you suppose that upon only that one Peter, the whole church is built by God, what would you say about John, the son of thunder, or about each one of the apostles? Shall we dare to say that the gates of Hades will not prevail against Peter in particular, but they will prevail against the other apostles and the perfect, he would mean a complete Christian. Does not the saying previously made, the gates of Hades will not prevail against it, apply in regard to all? Are the keys of the kingdom of heaven given by the Lord to Peter only, and will none of the other blessed receive them? So Origen did not share the Roman Catholic view. Again, on that same page, in this place, he's talking about Matthew 16, 18 and 19, these words seem to be addressed to only Peter. Whatever you will bind on earth will be bound in heaven. However, in the Gospel of John, the Savior gave the Holy Spirit to the disciples by breathing upon them and said, receive the Holy Spirit. Many then will say to the Savior, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And if anyone says this to him, through the Father in heaven, he will obtain the things that were spoken according to the language of the gospel to Peter. For all who are the imitators of Christ bear the surname of Rock. Furthermore, as members of Christ, they derive their surname from him, being called Christians. And from the rock, they are called Peters. One more from Origen. This is in volume 4, page 429, in another work. Peter himself seems to have observed for a considerable time the Jewish observances commanded by the law of Moses, for he had not yet learned from Jesus to ascend from the law that is regulated according to the letter to that which is interpreted according to the Spirit. Moreover, in the epistle to the Galatians, Paul states that Peter, from fear of the Jews, ceased to eat with the Gentiles upon the arrival of James. Let me read to you from Victorinus. This is in volume 6, page 360, and this would be in the late 200s. Even though the floods of the nations and the vain superstitions of heretics should revolt against the true faith, they are overcome and shall be dissolved as the foam, because Christ is the rock by which and on which the church is founded. So again, there was a difference of opinion. Some saying the rock was Peter, some saying it was Peter at first, but it applied to all the apostles or to every Christian who makes the same acknowledgement of faith. Victorinus said, no, that's talking about Jesus, that he's the rock. So there wasn't a uniform interpretation in the early church or even in the years after Constantine. For example, Augustine, who's been one of the primary fathers of the Roman Catholic Church, he did not understand that passage to be talking to Peter or to Peter alone. Now, the other important thing is that none of the early Christian writers made any claims that everyone had to submit to Peter. He was simply the first among equals. And that's how it should have been, because after all, Jesus instructed his apostles in the way that it was to be. He says, they, the Pharisees, love the best places at feasts, the best seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplaces, and to be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi. But you do not be called Rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Christ, and you are all brethren. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. And do not be called teachers, for one is your teacher, the Christ. But he who is greatest among you shall be your servant, and whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. Matthew 23:6-12. So Jesus had no plans whatsoever of leaving someone as the prince of the apostles who would lord it over the other apostles, or who would have successors that would lord it over every other congregation on earth, claiming to be alone the infallible bishop who could speak with authority from God. It's very foreign to the leadership that Jesus instructed his apostles to give the church. The type of leadership that Jesus left to the church, and that was one of servant leadership. And the New Testament, I think, testifies very eloquently to the fact that this is how things were, just as Jesus said they were going to be. Peter is perhaps the most prominent of the original 12 in the book of Acts, but he hardly acts like a prince or ruler over the others. In fact, when the council was called in Jerusalem over the issue of circumcision, it's very interesting that it wasn't Peter who presided, it was James. Acts 21:15 says, and after those days, we packed and went up to Jerusalem. Also, some of the disciples from Caesarea went with us. On the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. So, when Paul went to Jerusalem on this particular occasion, it was James in particular that he went to see. He's the one who's spoken of with some preeminence, not as a Gentile ruler lording it over people, but as being the as his terms are, the chief of the apostles, the cornerstones, the pillars, etc. So I think I could probably, taking the books of Acts, make a better claim that James was the one who the keys of the kingdom were left to, or that was the prince over the apostles, if someone were to make that claim, if I wanted to make that claim. But Again, that would be very foreign to the type of leadership that Jesus left to the church. Paul had no problem in standing face to face and disputing with Peter. We read, "But when Peter had come to Antioch, I withstood him to his face, because he was to be blamed." That's Galatians 2:11. Boy, no sign there of a prince that everyone had to bow down to and accept his word. Then Galatians 2, verse 9. "When James, Cephas, and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that had been given to me, they gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship, that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised." Here we see a plurality of leadership. James, Cephas, or Peter, and John. It wasn't one man. And he simply says they seemed to be pillars. They were the natural leaders there, but not because they had some kind of Christ-given authority over the other apostles. In fact, they were quite willing to make a division that Paul would go to the Gentiles and they would go to the Jews. And since by the end of the century the church was predominantly Gentile, Paul, in the end, ended up having more influence than did Peter. The Lord inspired him to write far more than he did Peter. So this puts Peter and the claims about him in a little different light. I think we can say, at most, he was the first among equals. He was one of the pillars of the church. But even looking at this and the role and authority that Peter had, sometimes it's so easy to forget that it is a huge jump from looking at Peter and then saying whatever status he had applied to all the future bishops of Rome. Yeah, I've listened to Roman Catholic apologists that seem to act like, boy, if they can show that Peter was preeminent, well, we've just proved the Pope is the head of the church. But there are two very distinct issues. And very interestingly, finally today, if you look at Roman Catholic scholarship, and this would be the more liberal scholars, they would almost uniformly deny all of these claims about Peter. All these claims that Rome has historically made for century upon century upon century. Now its very own scholars are beginning to point out some of the very things that Protestants had pointed out for several hundred years. At the same time, I'm finding among Protestant scholars that there is a growing recognition that Peter did have some sort of preeminence, if nothing more, and evidently more, nothing more than being first among equals. But I am finding that Protestant scholars are moving away from, I think, their overreaction to the claims of Rome on that account. Okay, now the next question, you know, I say it's a big jump from Peter to the bishops of Rome. The next step is, does Peter have any connection with Rome in the first place? Now, I was raised to believe that Peter was never in Rome. His letter says he's writing from Babylon, and I was always told that meant literal Babylon. That it was the Roman Catholics who invented this idea that Peter had been in Rome, because the scriptures certainly say nothing about that. But again, the evidence from the early Christian writings really surprised me. I'm going to read to you from Irenaeus. This is in volume 1, page 414. He said, "Matthew also issued a written gospel among the Hebrews in their own dialect, while Peter and Paul were preaching at Rome and laying the foundations of the church. After their departure, Mark, the disciple and interpreter of Peter, also handed down to us in writing what had been preached by Peter." And Irenaeus, who wrote this, was not a Roman himself. He was from the East and had settled in Gaul, modern-day France, where he was the bishop or overseer in the city of Lyon. He writes again on page 415 of volume 1, "The universally known church was founded and organized at Rome by the two most glorious apostles, Peter and Paul. Clement of Alexandria says this, volume 2, page 573. Mark was the follower of Peter when Peter publicly preached the gospel at Rome before some of Caesar's equestrian knights. Arnobius, writing about the year 305 in volume 6, page 438, says, talking about the people of Rome, that they had seen the chariot of Simon Magus, his fiery car, blown into pieces by the mouth of Peter and vanish when Christ was named. Peter of Alexandria, writing about the year 310, says, Peter, the first of the apostles, was often arrested, thrown into prison, and treated with dishonor. He was finally crucified at Rome. And again, Lactantius, writing around the year 304 up to 310, somewhere in there, volume 7, page 123, he says, Peter and Paul preached at Rome. And again, on pages 301 and 302. While Nero reigned, the apostle Peter came to Rome. Through the power of God committed to him, he worked certain miracles. And by turning many to the true religion, he built up a faithful and steadfast temple unto the Lord. It was Nero who first persecuted the servants of God. He crucified Peter and slew Paul. So, very definitely the belief that Peter had preached in Rome, had helped found the church, or if not planted, at least help establish it there, and that he was martyred there by crucifixion. There are quite a number of witnesses to that, and none of these people that I've read are of the city of Rome. They're from all over the Roman world at that time, so it wasn't something that just Rome, the church in Rome, had invented. On the other hand, it's been pointed out to me that look at the lateness of those quotes that I've just read. The earliest was from Irenaeus, somewhere between the year 170 and 180. And this would have been at least a century after Peter and Paul died, since the tradition is that they were martyred during the reign of Nero. So it would be more than a century later. And definitely myths and traditions can grow in that period of time. And so that's definitely a possibility. Since these witnesses are a little bit late, they're not conclusive evidence, that's for sure. Now, with that tradition in mind, however, notice this quote from Clement of Rome, which would date back to the year 96. You can find it in volume 1, page 6. Through envy and jealousy, the greatest and most righteous pillars have been persecuted and put to death. Let us set before our eyes the illustrious apostles. Peter, through unrighteous envy, endured not one or two, but numerous labors. And when he had at length suffered martyrdom, he departed to the place of glory due to him. Now that quote in itself doesn't prove that Peter was martyred in Rome. And you really have to read the entire page to get the full sense of the context. This is being written by one of the leaders in the church at Rome. And in reading the passage, it certainly sounds like they're talking about somebody that they had seen that was recent history in their city. On the other hand, it is not conclusive evidence. Again, another very early witness would be the letter of Ignatius to the Romans, which would date to about the year 105. And this is on page 75 of volume 1 of the Ante-Nicene Fathers. He's in writing the church there, he says, I do not, as Peter and Paul, issue commandments to you. They were apostles. I am but a condemned man. Again, that doesn't prove that Peter and Paul were actually there in Rome, he doesn't specifically say that, but that would be the implication. He says, they commanded to you, but I'm not commanding you. On the other hand, he's writing them a letter, and so any command he would have given would have been in the letter, and so it could be certainly put forth that he may have meant Peter and Paul wrote them and gave them exhortations and commands. And then another early witness we have, unfortunately, has been lost, and it's been preserved only in the history that Eusebius wrote. And he says this: "It is related that in his reign, Paul was Nero's. Paul was beheaded in Rome itself, and that Peter was also crucified, and the cemeteries there, still called by the names of Peter and Paul, confirm the record. So does a churchman named Gaius, who lived when Zephyrinus was bishop of Rome." And this would have been quite early. "In a written dialogue with Proclus, the leader of the Phrygian opinion," that's the Montanists, "Gaius says the following about the places where the sacred remains of the apostles in question are laid." He means Peter and Paul. And now he quotes from Gaius: "I can point out the trophies or monuments of the apostles. If you will go to the Vatican or the Ostian Way, you will find the trophies of those who founded this church." Now don't get scared by the word Vatican there. That was a name of the place long before the Roman Catholic Church came to be associated with that. So when he talks about the Vatican, he's not talking about what we think of as the Vatican today. Well, against quite a number of witnesses, on the other side, we really don't have anything but to say, hey, the New Testament doesn't say that, and so we don't know for certain. And that's basically it. We just have to use the silence as an argument. But I'm trying to be honest in giving you all the evidence that we have. So far, what do we have from the evidence? I think we've got a fairly good record to show that the primitive church did look at Peter as the foremost, you might say, of the apostles, at first among equals, and that the historical record would indicate that he did preach and die in the city of Rome. Well, then, does that get us to the Pope and all of the claims the Roman Catholic Church makes about the Pope? Not in the least bit. That's all the evidence we have, is what I've just said. And it's a big jump from saying that Peter was the most eminent or foremost of the apostles, first among equals, and that he died in Rome, and then to jump from there and say, therefore, each bishop of Rome is the successor of Peter, that when he speaks on morals and doctrine, that he speaks infallibly, if he's speaking ex cathedra. I mean, no one even made that claim about Peter, that he was infallible when he spoke to the church. And there's absolutely no record, no witnesses from the early century saying that the Bishop of Rome then was the successor of Peter, and that he had all of the authority that supposedly Peter had. In fact, if we look at the earliest record, and that's of the Scriptures, we know for a fact from the book of Acts that Peter preached at the churches of Jerusalem and Antioch. So from the historical record, the bishops of Jerusalem and Antioch have just as much right as the bishops of Rome to claim to be the successors of Peter. Jerusalem was the first church, and it was the one you could say really was established actually by all 12 apostles on the day of Pentecost, and Peter being the main spokesman at that time. It's Jesus had preached in Jerusalem and was martyred there, which is certainly greater than Peter being martyred in Rome. And Jesus, we know for a fact, was never in Rome. So just because you can show Peter was in Rome, or at least, you know, make a strong case for it, well, what does that prove? You haven't shown anything that the bishops in Jerusalem could claim all of the same rights. Or how about Antioch? That's where the followers of Jesus were first called Christians. But really, the issue is, does anyone have the right to make such a claim? Did Jesus say to Peter, "To you and your successors, I will give the keys of the kingdom"? Did he say, "Whatever you and your successors bind on earth"? I mean, even if we're going to take his words as applying only to Peter, which was not the predominant view of the early church, it still doesn't get us to any supposed successors of Peter. Jesus said nothing about any successors. Are we to believe that a bishop who served as overseer in the church at Rome after Peter had died had more authority from God than the other apostles had, than Paul had? Are we to believe that? See, there's this gigantic jump from what historical evidence we do have to the claims that are being made. And there's absolutely no scriptural authority for any of those claims, and there's no authority in the earliest years of the primitive church. Now, the historical record does show that fairly early on, the bishops of Rome were claiming superiority over the other churches and were claiming to be the successors of Peter. Although, interestingly, in the second century, when people like Irenaeus talk about the church in Rome and its eminent position, they always speak about Peter and Paul. But then when you get into the third century and later, it's always this thing of, well, Peter being there. Because, like I say, they're starting to make this claim that I'm Peter's successor, which had not been made before. And yet it started gradually. I mean, when you first see evidence of it, it's not some full-blown thing. And like I say, it's being made by the Bishop of Rome, not by somebody else. For example, well, now this isn't an example of any claims being made, but an example of the church in Rome exercising leadership. You have a situation when the church in Corinth had booted out the elders that the apostles had ordained and put in place there, and ordained new men of their own choosing, that the church in Rome wrote to the church in Corinth, because they had been asked to. Some people from Corinth, some members of the church, had written there and asked for their help. And the letter in itself is very interesting, reading what's called First Clement. Now, his name isn't on there. It's just written from the elders or presbyters in the church at Rome. And it's not written, the tone of it isn't, we have some authority over you, you have to do what we command. I mean, really, that letter in itself disproves the whole claims of the Roman Catholic Church, because if they were the successor of Peter, the Bishop of Rome, well, then that would have to be established early on. In other words, it can't be something that just happens 200, 300 years later. I mean, either the elders or the bishop in Rome, say in the year 90, was Peter's successor, and if he wasn't, nobody else after him was. And interestingly, modern Roman Catholic scholars today would say there was no such thing as a monarchical bishop in the first century, that was a later development, probably the year 150 or later. I mean, this is Roman Catholic scholars saying this. So that totally blows apart the whole claims of Rome if there wasn't even somebody that you could call a bishop in those early years. Like I say, the letter of Clement would be enormous evidence to that very fact, because if there was a single bishop and he was viewed as Peter's successor, well, naturally he would write in his own name, I, Clement, successor of Peter, blah, blah, blah. But like I say, it's written from the elders of Rome. And it's only later tradition in history that says that Clement penned the letter. And whether that was in the capacity as more the secretary or ambassador of the church, or as truly an overseer of the church, we really don't know. He makes no claims in the letter because, like I say, it's written from the whole body of elders, and it's addressed to all of the elders in Corinth, which would again indicate you did not have single monarchical bishops at that time. And yet I think it's fair to say that the church in Rome was the largest church probably anywhere in the world, because Rome was the largest city, at least in the Mediterranean world, and that Paul definitely was there, and strong evidence that Peter was there, and more than likely they were both martyred there, as the little bit of historical record we have would indicate. Would you know, Paul, one of Paul's letters was directly addressed to Rome, and very likely Peter's letter saying from Babylon meant from Rome. That's how the early Christians understood that Babylon was a symbol for Rome. But again, it's a very big difference between saying a church is, you know, a particularly predominant church or an important one, and then claiming to have apostolic authority over all other churches. Because again, you could say the same thing about the church in Jerusalem. In the beginning, in the first decade, maybe the first two decades of the church, the predominant church was not the one in Rome, it was the one in Jerusalem. I mean, when the issue came up about circumcision, they went to Jerusalem. It was in Jerusalem where the church was founded. So, you know, originally, the most important church was Jerusalem. And again, that shows that just because you were an important church doesn't give you some mastery over all other churches. Certainly, the church in Jerusalem did not have mastery over all other churches, let alone Rome, which rose to prominence only later. Okay, now, somewhere prior to the year 150, we have a record from Irenaeus that there had been a dispute between Polycarp, who was bishop or overseer in Smyrna, and Anicetus, who was the bishop in Rome. And this is what Irenaeus tells us, and since he was a disciple of Polycarp, this is coming from pretty good authority. When the blessed Polycarp was visiting in Rome in the time of Bishop Anicetus, they were at once well inclined towards each other. They were not willing that any quarrel should arise between them upon this matter. Now, this matter is the issue of when to celebrate Pascha, or the Christian Passover, known in English-speaking countries as Easter. That's not how it was known back then. And the issues were the churches in Asia Minor, where John had had his predominant ministry, their custom was they would follow the calendar day that Jesus was put to death on Nisan 14th, and which is on the Jewish lunar calendar. And so then their celebration of his resurrection then on Nisan 16th, they would follow the calendar just like we normally do. I mean, July 4th, say for an American holiday, sometimes it falls on a Saturday, sometimes on a Wednesday. But we always celebrate July 4th, not a certain day of the week. Christmas, I mean, you look at all of our holidays, you know, they follow a calendar day. And likewise, the Passover, which was the precedent for the Christian Pascha or Passover, didn't fall on a particular day of the week. It fell on whatever day Nisan 14th fell on. So anyway, the custom in Asia Minor then was to follow the calendar date. And if that meant you're celebrating on a Wednesday or a Tuesday, that's what you do. But in Rome, they were saying, well, our custom is to always celebrate it on a Sunday. And so it's the first Sunday after the Nisan 14th of the spring equinox. And, you know, who cares? And no one had any issues about this that we know of before the year 150. And the only reason the issue came up is because Rome being such a large city, a lot of people moved there from all over the empire. And so you had Christians moving there from the east, and they're celebrating Pascha on a different day that other Christians in Rome are celebrating. And their custom was to fast several days, or at least the day before celebrating the resurrection, to commemorate the days that Jesus was in the tomb. And then on the morning of the resurrection day, what we call Easter here, then there was great celebration and joy and feasting, you know, to celebrate this wonderful occurrence, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so you had some Christians celebrating while other ones were fasting. That's why there was an issue. Anyway, he said that Polycarp and Anicetus were not willing that any quarrel should arise between them upon this matter. Anicetus could not persuade Polycarp to forego the observance of his Easter customs, for these things had been always observed by John, the disciple of our Lord, and by other apostles with whom Polycarp had been conversant. Nor, on the other hand, could Polycarp succeed in persuading Anicetus to keep Pascha in his way. For Anicetus maintained that he was bound to adhere to the usage of the presbyters, or elders, who preceded him. And in this state of affairs, they held fellowship with each other. That account is in Volume 1, page 569. Now, that passage from Irenaeus is quite important for the insights that it gives us on this issue of was the Bishop of Rome really viewed as the successor to Peter? Because here you have two bishops, one the Bishop of Rome, one a bishop in Asia Minor. And if there had been any thought that, well, number one, Peter was the prince of the apostles and everyone had to submit to Peter, and number two, that the bishop in Rome, whoever sat there, was the successor of Peter, well, obviously Polycarp wouldn't have come and said, you know, I can't do it your way. It wasn't a matter of him coming there and you know, prostrating at the feet of the Pope and saying, you know, I ask permission for this indulgence to be able to celebrate Pascha in the way that we do it. No. I mean, he went there as an equal because there were trouble brewing affecting Christians who had moved from Asia Minor. And Polycarp went there and said, look, I've got to do it the way that I saw John do it. And it's interesting that Polycarp is claiming for the practice there an apostle, John, and he says other apostles that he witnessed. And I don't know if you caught this as I read that Anicetus, the Bishop of Rome, could only say that he had to adhere to the use of the presbyters who preceded him. He can't claim an apostle gave this practice of commemorating it always on Sunday, even if it falls on a different day of the year than the day that Jesus was actually resurrected. So it's quite interesting what this reveals, and certainly there's no feeling at that point in time that everyone has to submit to the Bishop of Rome, nor is the Bishop of Rome claiming that. He was very happy to work this out with Polycarp. Interestingly, this same issue came up again maybe about 40 years later in the time of Irenaeus, and that's the reason why Irenaeus mentions what had happened with Polycarp, because he went to Rome to get the Bishop of Rome to back down, who was trying to force other churches to follow the practice that was there in Rome. And then after the time of Irenaeus, like I say, you get into the 3rd century, you really start seeing the Bishop of Rome making some fairly aggrandized claims, although again, nothing close to what the Roman Catholic Church today would claim for the Pope. The other thing that history brings out, and there's quite a detailed historical record on it, is that very early on, the church in Rome got carried away with its power and prestige and became the seat of moral laxity, of laxity in church discipline. In the days of Paul and his letter to the Romans, at that time, Rome was quite a faithful church. And the same was true in the days of Clement of Rome, and I think in the early part of the 2nd century. But by around the year 200, you have people who weren't necessarily the most godly of men, obtaining the, you have first of all the introduction of monarchical bishops, which seems to be a different custom than what the apostles handed down, number one. Number two, you see men who weren't of the most pristine character becoming the bishops of Rome. The other thing, and this you've got to read the whole Ante-Nicene Fathers or take my word for it, because there's not any quote I can render, but the thing you notice when you read the Ante-Nicene Fathers is that these are not bishops of Rome. The writings that are on theology are not coming out of Rome. And it's not the popes who are issuing edicts or making proclamations on theology. In fact, more than once, the bishops of Rome were actually teaching heretical views that had to be corrected by other people in the church. And in the days of Hippolytus, which would be around the year 200, you first see one of the schisms in the church, not over doctrine or heresy or that. I mean, not no heresy on the part of the schism, but because people were seeing that the bishops of Rome had become very lax in their discipline and were allowing all kinds of ungodly things. And so Hippolytus led a reform movement, a group that broke off from the main church in Rome because of their outrage over what was happening. And this is what Hippolytus tells us. You can find this in volume 5, page 131. He calls the Callistus, who is the bishop of Rome, the imposter. He says, the imposter, having ventured on such opinions, talking about some of his erroneous theological viewpoints, established a school in antagonism to the church, and he adopted the foregoing system of instruction. And he first invented the device of conniving with men in regard to their indulgences in pleasures, saying he could forgive the sins of everyone. For if anyone commits any transgression, they say the sin is not counted to him, provided only he hurries off to the school of Callistus. This would be like a school of thought he's talking about. This is true even if the person is in the habit of attending the congregation of anyone else. He only needs to be called a Christian, and many persons were gratified with his regulation. However, some of them, in accordance with my condemnatory sentence, had been by me forcibly ejected from the church, yet they passed over to him and served to crowd his school. So Hippolytus, who was an elder, had excommunicated people in his congregation who were ungodly. And then they would just go over to the congregation headed by Callistus, and he would accept them in. And so he curried favor that way and gained a large popular following. And you see that as becoming the norm in later years. I mean, there were times when people were killing one another, and I mean not in the far distant future from this. So-called Christians were killing each other over who they were going to elect the Bishop of Rome. But you can see this starting about the year 200. And I know many persons, they just brush off Hippolytus, say, oh, it's sour grapes or that sort of thing. But not very long later, it's Novatian, again, another elder in Rome, seeing the moral laxitude and lack of discipline being allowed by the bishops, the Bishop of Rome at that time. And so he started his own reform church. And unlike that of Hippolytus, his lasted long after he had died. And obviously, if there wasn't some moral problem there, it would be hard to account for how could a church rise up with the power and longevity of the Novatians if there wasn't some basis to their claim of moral laxity in the Bishop of Rome. And then around the year 250, you have a major fallout with the Bishop of Rome, who at that time was Stephen, over the issue of rebaptizing heretics. The practice in Rome, and in a number of other places, was that you did not rebaptize heretics. You did not rebaptize them in water. You would lay hands on them and pray for them to receive the Holy Spirit, but you didn't redo their water baptism. But that was not the universal practice. Other writers attested different customs in other churches. In other words, it wasn't a uniform practice throughout all of the churches, which again would go to disprove this claim of a monarch, a single pope or bishop who has authority over all of the church, because, like I say, churches had differing practices on it, just like they did on the celebration of Pascha, or what we know as Easter. And Cyprian really took Stephen to task on this. Not, I mean, his view was, look, if you want to do that in Rome, that's your business. But here in Carthage, our tradition and our practice is that we rebaptize them in water. Because they believed, and if you've heard the message on baptism, that the new birth is closely tied to water baptism. I mean, that's one half of it. The other is spirit baptism. And he says, how can someone who's not part of the church themselves grant a birth to somebody else? That doesn't make any sense. And his reasoning is quite logical in that regard. But again, he was very gracious. You know, if you want to do something else in Rome, then that's your business. Because there was independence. Each bishop, each church, each congregation, each city was independent. And yet they all worked together as a team, as members of one body, but not with any one member claiming to be the head over others. But now what Stephen did, and this is like, say, about the year 250, was to say, if you don't do it my way, if you don't do it the way we're doing it in Rome, then we're going to excommunicate you. And that's what they started doing, was excommunicating these churches. And so Cyprian says, you can excommunicate me if you want to do that. And a friend of Cyprian's, Firmilian, he was an Eastern bishop, and after Stephen had excommunicated all of these people, this is what Firmilian writes to him. And again, anyone who would say that the Bishop of Rome was looked upon as the leader, the follower, the prince or father of the church, listen to this letter. He says, I am justly indignant at this open and manifest folly of Stephen. He was the Bishop of Rome. He boasts of the place of his episcopate and contends that he holds the succession from Peter, on whom the foundations of the church were laid. So see, that claim, you can trace that back to 250 with Stephen, and maybe some hints of it, you know, in the 50 years before then. Yet he introduces many other rocks and establishes the new buildings of many heretical churches. That's because he would accept their baptism. He does not understand that the truth of the Christian rock is overshadowed and in some measure abolished by him when he betrays and deserts unity in this manner. Because he was the one breaking the unity of the church. The churches in the East who didn't agree with the custom in Rome, and certainly their custom was probably more apostolic, since the apostles had carried out most of their ministry in the East, they didn't split the church over that, but Stephen was willing to split the church over by excommunicating anyone who wouldn't do it his way. Anyway, Firmilian continues, it's on page 396, how great a sin you have heaped up for yourself when you cut yourself off from so many flocks. For it is you yourself that you have cut off. Do not deceive yourself, for the real schismatic is the one who has made himself an apostate from the communion of ecclesiastical unity. Although you think that everyone can be excommunicated by you, you have really excommunicated yourself alone from everyone else. Not even the teachings of an apostle have been able to mold you to the rule of truth and peace. Although he warned and said, I beseech you to walk worthy of the calling by which you are called, with all lowliness and meekness, quoting there from Scripture. Then he says this sarcastically, how carefully has Stephen fulfilled these salutary commands and warnings of the apostle? How carefully he has first kept lowliness of mind and meekness. For what is more lowly or meek than to have disagreed with so many bishops throughout the whole world, breaking peace with each one of them in various kinds of conflict? At one time he has broken with the Eastern churches, as we are sure you know. At another time he has broken with you who are in the South. This is a letter to his friend Cyprian in Carthage. This is to have kept the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. He has cut himself off from the unity of love and made himself a stranger in all respects from his brethren. He has rebelled against the sacrament of baptism and the faith with the madness of rebellious dissension. That's interesting. You don't find that quote in these passages from the Roman Catholic apologists. He wants to claim that the church always accepted the Bishop of Rome as being the earthly head of the church. And yet, even when Rome was making the kind of outlandish claims that Stephen did and that continued on after that, still, Rome didn't appoint bishops throughout the world like it does today. It didn't even appoint the bishops in the West. Each church selected its own bishop, its own elders. It didn't come down from Rome like it does now. That was an innovation, something that came about in the Middle Ages, this business of the Pope selecting the bishops in all the countries around the world, or at least all of the ones in the West, because the East wasn't willing to accede to Rome's demands and claims. No one in the pre-Nicene church viewed Rome as having universal jurisdiction over the whole church, other than perhaps Stephen, the bishop there, who started this whole thing. In fact, not even the bishops of Rome claimed to be able to speak infallibly on matters of doctrine and morals in the period of the early church, or even in the early Middle Ages. I mean, that was a doctrine that developed over time and didn't even become dogma until the late 1800s. I think the truth is that today the only real claim to apostolicity for any church is this: is it holding fast to the apostolic faith? Is it holding fast to the faith once for all delivered to the saints? If it isn't, it's not an apostolic church. It doesn't matter if its bishop sits in Rome or Jerusalem or anywhere else. Now, before leaving this subject, I want to point out one more serious objection to the claims of Rome. You know, the people in the Roman Catholic Church all refer to the earthly head of their church, the Bishop of Rome, as the Pope. Now, the word Pope is simply a variant of the word Papa. To call someone the Pope is the same thing as calling him the Papa, the Father. You know, what did we read earlier from the mouth of Jesus himself? He said, "But you do not be called Rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Christ, and you are all brethren. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. And do not be called teachers, for one is your teacher, the Christ." I mean, that should be a dead giveaway right there. Jesus commands us to call nobody by the title of father. And here he's speaking of ecclesiastical titles. So don't let the Roman Catholic Church there, and their apologists, they're very smooth. And they say, "Well, don't you call your own dad father?" Well, yeah, see, you can't take that literally. He's not talking about that sort of thing. He's talking about religious titles. He was addressing the errors and sins of the scribes and Pharisees, because they like to be called father and rabbi and titles like that. And he's saying, don't put a title in front of your name. Not even teacher, like Peter the teacher, John the rabbi. Don't do that, he said. I'm your teacher, I'm your rabbi. None of you should take on any titles. And yet here is a church that specifically gives that very title to its leader, the very thing Jesus commanded us not to do. And how different that is from the spirit of Peter himself. Go back and read the book of Acts. Did Peter or any of the other apostles affix titles to their names? When they address Peter, do they call him Father? Do they call him Apostle Peter? No, they just call him Peter. It's that simple. Or John. It's always just their first name. Read their letters, just from Peter or from Paul. Never is anyone given a title with their name. So now, if the apostles themselves, who had been personally handpicked and ordained by Jesus Christ himself, and Revelation says that the New Jerusalem is built upon the 12 apostles as foundation stones, and if they were unwilling to put a title in front of their name, how wrong it is for the bishops of Rome to elevate themselves over other Christians and over even the apostles by taking on titles that Jesus prohibited his disciples to have. Well, so much for the claims of Rome. Tomorrow night we're going to be looking at the claims made by the Eastern Orthodox Church, particularly about the so-called seven ecumenical councils.